Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of October 24th, 2014. As a kid, I adored Halloween. I planned costumes for months in advance, the weirder the better. Scary was definitely a selling point, like when my brother and I frightened ourselves by decorating the yard like the Blair Witch Project. Fear is fascinating. As a deterrent or a reason to buy, sell, or take chances. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. You're going to hear about fear on this show. Fear in the markets, fear of being scammed, fear of Ebola. But you'll also get the flip side, the good things that fear can push us to do. As always, you can tell us scary stories. We're at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
The new iPhone 6 has something called Apple Pay, which lets you store and use your credit cards just by scanning your phone.
The housing market is cooling. So to give you some more data, earlier in this year, home values were increasing about 8% year over year. Now they're increasing about 6.5% year over year.
Mark Zuckerberg, speaking Mandarin Chinese during a Q&A session at Tsinghua University on Wednesday.
Well, from China back to the U.S., this week, New York saw its first case of Ebola in a doctor who had worked in Guinea. And one of the most complicated aspects of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is the climate of fear and sometimes hysteria surrounding it. In the U.S., that's been felt keenly in communities with large West African populations. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has been reporting on a largely Liberian community here in New York and joins me now to talk about it. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Lizzie.
Tell me why you started to report this story.
Mostly because this is one of the largest Liberian communities in the U.S., and so the idea was to just spend the afternoon there exploring and seeing how Ebola was affecting them or not. Locally here in the U.S., because it's a disease that's obviously very far away.
And this is, I think, a complicated thing for a reporter to do because you're trying to talk to a heavily Liberian community and yet with the recognition that this is an American community.
Exactly. And this is a disease that is, for the most part, not in the U.S. And so the idea of how is this affecting them here, it's kind of a tricky question. You want to be careful not to create more fear, but yet there is some fear there, and to sort of tell that story was interesting and a challenge for me.
You went to a town meeting, correct?
I did. There were a slew of public officials gathering with members of the Staten Island community in a section known as Little Liberia.
Let's listen to Barbara, who was asking one of the questions at the town meeting.
Hi, my name is Barbara. I want to know why the federal government cannot ban these people from coming into the United States.
I heard boos there from the crowd. What was that moment like?
Yeah, that was a particularly tense moment. And actually, Barbara turned and walked straight out.
But she's left the
room. The reaction from the crowd was so kind of forceful, and it took a minute for officials to quiet people down and answer the question. And that question is actually floating around. You know, there are calls from some politicians to create a travel ban.
I want to talk about the economics of this because that was a question that also came up at the meeting about people who maybe work in the healthcare field or are potentially exposed to some type of discrimination at work right now because of this climate of fear. Let's listen to that.
For the people who live in Staten Island and the Park Hill community and Fox Hills, we want to make sure that you are not the unintended victims of being stigmatized by those who think that you might have it simply because of where you come from. And there's a concern among your employers about whether or not they should have you at work. I see you shaking your head. We need to make sure that your employers are equally educated about the risks or the lack of risk so that you don't suffer economically as a result of this.
That's State Senator Diane Savino. And she really wanted to make sure that if this is happening, because there are right now there are a few kind of anecdotal reports of people being told to stay home from work. And so she wanted to get the message out to the community that if this happens to them, they want people to report it. It's not okay.
Were people concerned or worried that that might happen to them?
I think, you know, people told me that a friend maybe didn't want to shake their hand when they were greeting each other, or that there weren't as many people coming to this local West African market as there had been in the past. And so there is this sense that people are changing their behavior, whether or not that will go further and translate to being told to stay home from work. We don't know yet, and we hope that that doesn't happen. There's a twofold nature about the economics of this as well, because you have people who are working in the United States sending money home to relatives in Liberia or who plan to visit and aren't doing that. Now, I want to play one more piece of tape from someone you talked to.
I've been going to Liberia the last few years. This year, I canceled my trip. I should have taken my two-year-old daughter to Liberia to go and see her grandparents. But I can't do that only because of the Ebola. We canceled that trip.
That's Telly Brown. He's a social worker, and he also is the chairman of the Staten Island Liberians Ebola Fund. And this has affected his holiday plans, as you heard. And so there's that second wave. People come and go from Staten Island to Liberia regularly. That's another reason for that fear when you're in a public space. You don't know who's kind of come and gone recently. And, yeah, people are changing their plans.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Lizzie.
That was Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson. You can find a link to her story on our website, marketplace.org. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Here in the U.S., big media companies fear losing their audiences and struggle to adapt to the internet as more and more people get their news from smartphones. That's even more pronounced in Africa, where internet use on mobile phones is set to increase 20 times over the next 5 years. That's double the growth rate in the rest of the world. Our partners at the BBC have this story from Ghana, where you won't find a lot of young people with newsprint on their hands. Here's the BBC's Will Ross.
Dotted around the city of Accra and other cities across Ghana, you'll find these small newsstands. It looks like a wooden shed, and you cannot see any of the wood because it's entirely plastered with newspapers. There must be about 40 different titles on display, and they're all tied up there on pieces of string with wooden clothes pegs. The Daily Graphic, the government-owned paper, with a lead story about an abandoned footbridge. The Ghanaian Times, cops save fetish priest. But how long are these printing presses going to keep churning out the dailies as more and more people, especially the younger generation, are seeking their news online? This press belongs to the Independent Daily Guide and prints about 35,000 copies a day. The Daily Guide has an online site, although stories are not uploaded there until around noon in order to protect newspaper sales. But the editor, Fortune Alimi, says the biggest threat to the company is from Ghana's radio stations that review the newspapers every morning.
Some do it in a very professional way, by reading the headlines and maybe giving the gist of the stories. But some go detailed from cover to cover.
Reading it. Which means nobody needs to go and buy that paper if they've listened to that station.
That is what is affecting newspapers in Ghana.
Driving through Accra, you can't really miss the mixed fortunes of the economy. On the one hand, when you stop at the traffic lights, plenty of people come up to your car windows selling you anything from plastic toys to drinking water, key rings, all sorts of people scratching out a living. On the other hand, you drive past very fancy new apartment blocks going up. Another thing you see when you drive around are an enormous amount of adverts for a new internet company that set up, the first 4G network. It's called Surfline. I'm off to see Rosie Finn, who's the head of marketing at Surfline. I want to find out exactly what's going on in the internet space here in Ghana.
The smartphone penetration, I think, is going to be one of the key things that's going to drive internet usage in Ghana and probably for most of Africa. And this is why people are getting news a whole lot faster, because you're not sitting in your office and waiting to get online. Now you're doing it on the go all the time.
We are live on Joy 99.7 FM in Accra. Love 99.
In the race to provide news as fast as possible, it's the internet site set up by Ghana's leading radio stations that are proving to be more popular than the websites of the newspapers. MyJoyOnline.com is the leader, with well over a million unique visitors every month.
I just want to love you, share with me your problem.
I walk past the Joy FM radio studio, playing the latest Ghanaian hits, and into a small room where today the online journalists are focused on football.
The response with regards to...
There's a TV on the wall showing a live presidential inquiry into what went wrong at the World Cup. One of the journalists here, Ernest Della Aglanu, tells me he's delighted not to be working for a printed newspaper.
Online is fun. It's much more of the future than the newspaper. What I'll do today is what I'll see in the papers tomorrow. It means I'm ahead.
I meet documentary maker David Ampafor leafing through a copy of the Daily Graphic newspaper.
I saw an ad in the newspaper yesterday about Ebola, part of the public education. And one of the things that said there is that, you know, you have to wear protective clothing when you find out somebody has Ebola. I mean, how on earth is that? Who's going to find goggles and God knows what? You know, it's wrong. I mean, I want to deal with that because that concerns me. How do I do that? What? Newspaper? Go and write a rejoinder to the editor? I mean, if I had seen this online, I'd have a discussion going and we would be sorting things out.
Every Saturday, I have a video date with Grandma on Mommy's laptop.
And of course, when they have access, young children are also going online. So if the newspapers want to survive in this rapidly changing market, they might do well to look at how Ghanaian children have fallen in love with the internet.
Grandma and I get to do a lot. I even told her about WhatsApp, and now she says, LOLs mean lots of love.
That was Will Ross. That story came to us in partnership with the BBC. Coming up, Apple Pay is alive. But to use it, you need the new iPhone or an Apple Watch, and stores need special equipment.
I think that hardware hurdle could be really problematic for getting this truly off the ground and into the mainstream.
That's just ahead on Marketplace Weekend. Since it's the weekend, we asked some friends to join us, so let's have brunch. We are out having brunch in New York at the Pullman Kitchen on 2nd Avenue, and I've got Ben Walsh from the Huffington Post and Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine. Welcome to you both. Cheers.
Thanks. Cheers.
Hello. Jess, you've got some Halloween decorations there next to you.
Ah!
Yeah.
A bloody hand print.
Ooh, there.
That's sticky.
Yeah. One thing that's happening in the equity markets that's really interesting to me, which is these big companies, really standard American companies that make up the Dow, things like Coke and IBM, they're not doing well. They've had kind of a rough season. What's going on?
Really big companies are very hard to steer quickly and nimbly, and these are big companies that make a very specific product, and they can't really change what they do very quickly. And so, for instance, Coke, they spend billions of dollars a year to market caffeinated sugar water that they then sell at super high margins. That business...
That's a very cynical view of what they make, caffeinated sugar water.
That is a totally neutral description of what they make. The market for that rises and falls, and for a long time it's been rising. But if you look at a competitor of theirs, Pepsi, everyone likes Coke more than Pepsi. Pepsi as a business is better because they diversified into snack food.
I mean, I'm interested in these giant companies. We're thinking also Walmart, GE. You know, investors have kind of been kind of like, on them. I'm wondering what that says about us as American consumers, what we buy and what we don't buy, or if we're really fickle right now or still scarred.
I wonder if investors are just kind of catching on to what Ben was saying, which is that they've been hearing this line that companies that are big aren't nimble and they can't move quickly. And maybe so they're looking at these big companies and thinking that that might be a reason to rate them lower.
They're like battleships, I guess. They don't turn
like
easily?
They're battleships.
They are absolutely
like battleships.
Cruise ships. And they're battleships that are kind of pointed in the same general direction as the American consumer. And we've seen some bad data recently about Americans' ability to keep spending as much as they have been spending or increase their spending.
It's impossible to imagine a world without Coke. Coke will prevail.
Of course.
Yeah. Somehow, though. Very good. Right? They were doing it with Diet Coke, Coke Zero, because people are drinking fewer amounts of caffeinated sugar water.
They've clued into it being unhealthy and also maybe a little bit disgusting.
Yeah, no, they're
actually
honest.
Drinking more caffeinated sugar water.
If you think about it,
water.
What does Coke even taste like?
Summer?
America?
Yeah. Well, I want to contrast these big companies with, Jessica, something you've been writing about, the sharing economy. You wrote this amazing story about Airbnb. What Airbnb is trying to do in big cities around the country, they've been running into a lot of resistance. What's happening?
Airbnb is, you know, kind of great. I don't know if you guys have used it. You can rent other people's apartments, like it's a hotel room. It's having some problems in cities, like specifically in New York and San Francisco, where the real estate is really limited. They're kind of like islands. There's not very much affordable housing. Both cities have seen a huge influx of wealth. And so there's a lot of concerns that, you know, landlords will convert entire apartment buildings into Airbnbs, or that people will decide, you know, even brownstoners will decide that their garden apartment is better if they can do it for $200 a night instead of $2,000 a month. And so it's kind of taking away affordable housing in some ways. And I don't think it's a thing that Airbnb thought of when they started the company.
I was really interested in your story. There's a moment when you're talking to one of the founders, I think, and he shows you a personal email from someone who said, you know, during the recession, Airbnb saved us because we were able to rent out our place and make some money when we were losing our job.
Sure. That's what's really interesting about it. It's sort of like really good for people who are in like tight financial situations and really bad for them at the same time. In cities like New York and San Francisco, there's also like a safety issue. Like you're in these giant apartment buildings and, you know, you don't know who's renting the apartment next to you.
I wonder whether a lot of the technology that we've seen that enables things like Uber, like Airbnb, different ride-sharing apps, does this create even more of a two-track society? Does this create more inequality?
That's a really interesting question. I think it probably, in the long run, does. Because these jobs, these TaskRabbit jobs, these Lyft jobs, they don't provide any job security at all. They're really meant to be temporary positions.
I want to go overseas to one of my favorite weird stories of the week, which I think also tells us something about global economics, maybe, which is Kenny G's presence at the protests in Hong Kong. Kenny G somehow becoming, through his music, a symbol of
jazz.
Equivocation.
Yeah, I guess equivocation. So he goes over there, he says, I'm going to stand up with you protesters, does his thing, and then
sits down.
Yeah.
He goes to Hong Kong, goes and visits the protesters, and then the Chinese government reminds him that he has lots of fans in mainland China.
Which, by the way, it's like a 20-hour flight over there, and he might have thought of that on the way. I just don't know how that didn't occur to him.
I can't vouch for...
And so then he backed down. He was like, I'm sorry. Is that what happened?
He said, "I other people are using me as a symbol of the protesters.
What?
That was not my intention. I was simply walking around Hong Kong.
I just thought that you could get some groove on."
Basically fully retracted and went in line with Chinese state media. Very bizarre.
Am I drawing Am I creating too much of an allegory here if I'm starting to see this as, you know, thinking about how you sell yourself internationally, right? When people want to tap into growth markets, they basically want to tap into China and India. And I think if you are thinking about how to do that, if you're an American brand or European brand, suddenly you're like, how do I play by all the rules?
Totally.
It's very weird because to be a global brand, you have to be apolitical, essentially. But then to be an apolitical global brand, that means being okay with Chinese government policies, which are political by their nature. And so it's a weird dance that you have to do.
And we've seen Mark Zuckerberg do this dance in China.
Yes.
That's right.
I would pay money to see Mark Zuckerberg dancing at a Kenny G concert.
In a hoodie? I guess in a hoodie.
I don't think it ever comes off. I think he showers
with it. I don't know if you really dance to Kenny G. I think you just sort of sway romantically.
Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine, Ben Walsh from The Huffington Post. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. If you're afraid of being a jerk, here are a few tips from our next guest. Don't write entire sentences in emojis. Not everything is a photo opportunity. Chris Black is a brand consultant and the author of the forthcoming book, I Know You Think You Know It All, Advice to Help You Stop Looking Like a Jerk in Public and Online. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so just as a thought experiment, I'm going to read some tweets to you, and you're going to tell me if they're jerky, all right?
Okay.
The most interesting part of the Michael Phelps DUI is that as a multimillionaire, he chose to live in Baltimore. And then another one from the same person who said, I would rather have dental surgery than listen to a new Childish Gambino mixtape. I don't know. This person sounds kind of jerky to me.
Who
is that person?
That person is me.
Yeah.
That person is me. Those things are very, I mean, I think having an opinion can be a little jerky sometimes. That's the beauty of Twitter, though, I think, is that you can choose to follow me. And if you find that jerky, you can no longer be a part of that anymore. You know what I mean? I think that's the beauty of it.
Let's get into some rules. Tell me how not to be a jerk.
There's so many rules. I mean, there's 500 rules. Don't pull your phone out of the table. Don't use the term YOLO. It's expired. There's things that everyone can do, no matter what your age or what you're interested in. You know, airplane etiquette. There's all kinds of things we tackle in the book.
Are there specific sort of 21st century bits of this, do you think, that have come up the more parts of our lives that we spend online?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think things like some people like to make plans via Twitter. And that's not what it's used for. You know,
but who cares, right? Like, if I tweet at my friend, I'm going to see you at this bar for drinks.
Oh,
who's
if, there's
that
one, if there's one tweet, it's not hurting anyone. But I've seen it go much longer than that. And if there's multiple people involved, it can be a full, it can clog the feed, as they say.
When you thought about trying to kind of come up with entertaining rules of the road, what standard were you trying to adhere to? Is it a young person's standard?
For me, it was, I mean, I'm 32 years old, so I feel like I'm old enough to have a little perspective now, which I know might sound ridiculous to some people, but, you know, I'm old enough to look back
a little bit
and see that things have, you know, certain things are back in style, for example, or certain things are more accepted than they were 10 years ago. So I think 10 years is a nice amount of time to see things kind of develop and evolve. It's a standard that I made up, I guess, you know.
And 10 years from now, will you look back and say, oh, God, I was a jerk?
Oh, 100%. When I was working on this book, I mean, the way a lot of the research involved was you can download your Twitter history into an Excel file. So I was cringing at things I said in 2008. I'm just as guilty as everybody else. You know, it's a learning process. So I was working with someone and I was just like, wow, I can't believe I said that. You know, there's certain things I couldn't believe I did. But, you know, it's all out there. That's the crazy part about it. It's all there. It's all public now. That's there forever.
Did you learn anything about humanity in terms of how we put ourselves out in the world that you think is relevant, not just online, but kind of how you go forward in life in this process?
I think a lot of people in social situations are kind of preoccupied with all this stuff. Young people especially, it's like if you've grown up with the internet and grown up with an iPhone, it's a very different mindset than someone like me or you. I was stuck on a plane the other day and the girl in front of me, I looked down and she was, the speed at which she was moving through her social media accounts on her phone was mind-blowing to me. You know, and this person, again, is probably in her early 20s, but, like, flying through it, taking selfies, doing all of those things so quickly, and that was, like, it was clearly something she did all the time, no matter what the situation was.
It feels to me like one of the things you're trying to skewer here is narcissism.
The internet is the king of it. You know, it allows for it, and there's a fine line there between I have this thing I'm doing, I want you to know about it, versus which is totally okay. I mean, that's what it should be there for. You know, I'm going to use it to try to sell this book. But there's a line, you know, there's a fine line there. And I think a lot of people, it's like, you know, sharing a picture of your lunch and that sort of thing in particular is really grating to me. I don't think I'm the only one out there. I don't think I'm the only one that's bothered by that, you know?
Pick one rule for me that you think is surprising.
If you're over 30 years old and you haven't done something, then you shouldn't do it. And I think that's true with the selfie, especially. If you're not taking selfies, you're not putting those up all the time, and you're of a certain age, you shouldn't be doing that. I don't think that's who you're.
I don't need to start.
You don't need to start now. Exactly. That's a rule that I live by all the time. There's certain milestones in your life, and that's one of them, I think, that you don't need to be doing anymore. Selfie, to me, is obviously an overused word. I mean, there's the song with it in it now, but I think that is the like you mentioned earlier, the king of the narcissism. That's what defines it to me, because words are words, and that's very different. Those can be read differently, but a selfie is a selfie, and that's just, you know, there's no way to not think that's narcissistic.
Chris Black is the author of I Know You Think You Know It All, advice to help you stop looking like a jerk in public and online. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
I'm expressing with my full capabilities, and now I'm living in correctional facilities, because some don't agree with how I do this.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Sir, it's quite possible this asteroid is not entirely stable.
Not entirely stable. I'm glad you're here to tell us these things. Chewie, take the professor in the back and plug him into the hyperdrive.
Sometimes I just don't understand human behavior.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. So we are going to talk about Apple, because anytime Apple releases something, it's very buzzy. Everybody starts talking about it. But this is different. We're not talking about a phone. We're not talking about software. Tee it up for me.
All right. So Apple Pay has finally officially debuted.
Apple Pay.
It's this way for us to pay without pulling our wallet out, as the, you know, the Apple video showed when they released this. And what you do is you have your iPhone 6 or your Apple Watch of the future, which would interact with your iPhone 5, for instance, and you would wave your watch or your phone in front of one of these little kiosks at a business and be able to pay just with your phone. The phone actually stores not the official credit card information, but some technology that is connected to your credit card, actually a chip. And you put your thumb over the thumbprint, the Touch ID thing, and you'll pay for whatever you're buying, groceries, something at Macy's, coffee, etc.
This is very futuristic and cool sounding, yes. But I'm going to play the klutz here, which is not all that far off of my role in real life. I have misplaced my phone.
Yes.
It has gone for exciting joyrides and taxis around New York City.
Yes.
If I have Apple Pay and I do that, something like that, what gives? How secure is this thing?
Okay, well, this is what's interesting, right? Apple is using this thing, and its partners like MasterCard and American Express are using this thing called tokenization, which is basically Apple has this like super fancy, super secure chip in the phone. It actually just has this token, this number that's connected to your credit card information back somewhere else. I know it sounds sketchy, but also you should think about this. You would have to, this person would also have to have your thumb to make this actually
work.
Well,
that sounds worse.
Yes. So I do think that it is a lot more secure in many ways. MasterCard, other credit cards have been thinking a lot about this, have been doing research on this sort of thing. And if they're on board, I think it's safe to say that this is fairly secure.
Okay, well, what about just all of the infrastructure that's built into this? I don't have an iPhone 6. Some places accept Apple Pay, some don't. That seems to me like there's a big hurdle to get customers and merchants to buy into this system.
And you've touched on the rub, Lizzie. This is the big question mark. Now, Apple has done some things that other earlier services have not done. You remember Google already has something like this.
Right, they tried this.
Uses some of the same technology, near-field communication, it's called. But Google doesn't have as many partners as Apple. Apple has gone out, has done these deals with both credit card companies and actual merchants that will do this and will, you know, have this stuff. And actually, by October 2015, individual stores will be liable for fraudulent credit card transactions if they don't have the right technology to deal with this sort of thing. There's also chip and PIN technology coming in our credit cards. So Apple is part of this updating our security wave that is slowly happening, right? But it's still problematic, because I went into a merchant the other day. I went in to buy my lunch. I said, hey, you going to use Apple Pay? And he was like, no, I already got Square, which, you know, works just as well.
Similar. You can swipe a credit card on a little device.
Exactly. And the merchant has to actually buy a piece of hardware, right? And also the person who's making the payment has to have an iPhone 6 or an Apple Watch. And I think that hardware hurdle could be really problematic for getting this truly off the ground and into the mainstream.
Is there a time frame for Apple where they will have to have sold enough of these products, the iPhone 6 or the Apple Watch, in order to make this worth the money they've invested in trying to, you know, get it up and running? Do we know yet?
This is a really good question. I'm not sure we know yet, and I don't know the specific numbers, but you'll remember several million iPhone 6s were sold in the first weekend they were available. Apple is expecting to sell between 60 and 70 million iPhone 6s alone. You get those people to actually start using those phones for paying for stuff. And
create the demand, and then they figure
exactly
the supply will take care of itself.
Yep.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app by visiting Google Play or the iTunes Store. Coming up, the markets are up, the markets are down, up, down. It's been a scary refrain over the past few weeks. Ladies and gentlemen, meet volatility.
You've got a lot of people who are freaked out about the amount of money that they could lose, so therefore they get very, very skittish when they see things starting to get a little bit unstable. They jump out of the market, and of course that then creates the swings. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
Just ahead on Marketplace Weekend. This past week, we asked our listeners and our community online about their financial horror stories. Yeah. All right, maybe we're being a little cheesy, but we wanted to know how you've been tripped up, if there's a scam that got you or almost did. David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times, and he's here to help untangle all of this. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
Obviously, we're going to get to your expertise in the matter, but I also want to play some stories from people who wrote us. The first one is from Nancy Harrison, and she wrote us about joining a financial partnership of sorts.
My husband is a chef, and he was offered a partnership. And the premise of the partnership was that he was a talent, and it was no buy-in because we had no money to buy half of a restaurant. So the person said, you know, you can walk away at any time, but if you stay, you'll get a piece of the profits and half of a restaurant and, you know, the prestige that comes. The chefs have a bit of an ego, although he would deny it, of owning half a restaurant. So they did this, and the restaurant was open for almost 3 years. But at the end of 3 years, it closed, and then we started getting bills from a bank that we had our mortgage with, and it was for a loan that we had never applied for. But apparently they had his signature, and as a partner, he was signed up for this loan that the bank would not forgive because they were saying, oh, you signed it, and so we had to take care of that. Then the guy was threatening us that he was going to sue us for half the business and lost profits and all this stuff. So I think that he didn't believe we would get a lawyer, but we did. And so far, it's all done.
David, I want to talk about what happened to Nancy and her husband. But it seems like there's also something very human that happened in this story where the entry point, the soft underbelly, if you will, is talent and ego and the desire to be successful at something that you love. How often does that come into play when you see people get scammed or make an unwise financial decision?
Well, it's common simply because you're playing to people's most vulnerable spot, and that's their ego. I think anybody who was listening to that will realize anytime you enter into any business relationship,
especially that partnership word, what was going on there?
Well, yeah, exactly. And what were the legal ramifications? And if you are an integral part of that, if you are indeed the talent, you want to protect yourself because you are going to be, well, the thing is going to sink or swim basically on you. And if it sinks, you want to protect yourself. And if it swims, you want to be riding that wave. So the idea that you're going to enter into any kind of relationship like that without a good, firm legal underpinning is to me a big red flag.
How do you protect yourself in advance if you are going to create a partnership or join forces with somebody?
When you enter any kind of relationship like that, you want to go in with your legal eyes open, which means somebody is going to be reading the paperwork, somebody's going to be offering some sort of legal advice, and someone is going to be making sure that your legal wagons are circled in case of any sort of trouble.
David, let's listen to another story that has all the seeds of a scam, and yet Drew Alexander, who wrote this letter, managed to pull the plug before she got totally financially hooked. But man, what a story. Let's listen to this.
I opened a profile on OkCupid. I received a notification, an email from somebody, and he was a very attractive man. He wrote me an email and he said, "I like your profile." So I responded. I said, "I could send you a photograph." And long story short, he did ask a lot of questions about my family and if I'd ever been married before. And so we kind of opened up to each other. And then suddenly he wrote me a note and he said that he has to suddenly fly for business. Fast forward, I was coming home from work one day and I got a call on my phone, my cell phone, and it came up as a Nigerian call. And then I didn't pick up because I was kind of startled by it. And then I got another call right away after that that said restricted. And he left me this voicemail that, in retrospect, I guess he didn't sound like he was Swedish. When I saw Nigeria, I immediately got suspicious. And because of the whole, you know, Nigerian email scams that have been going around. So I thought, that's weird. When I got home, I Googled OkCupid dating website scams. It opened up a floodgate of different sites. Apparently, I learned that this is a thing. And it's not like I thought this guy was really in love with me as much as I just could not believe I fell for it.
David, this is an amazing story to me. I mean, Drew did not go through with sending this guy any money, but other people have. There's a man in New York who sued OkCupid because he says he was scammed out of $70,000 by someone who was posing as someone else online. I wonder if the age of the internet and the amount of sharing that we do of little bits of ourselves makes people more vulnerable to scams.
What we're looking at here is a combination of scams and scamming techniques that are being used in a more sophisticated fashion. At the core of this is the old favorite, the Nigerian 411
scam. Nigerian land scam, yep.
Where they're going to move a whole lot of money into your bank account. All you have to do is provide the details. Thank you very much. Now, thanks to the social media and the dating site aspect of this, we're seeing social engineering involved. And what that means is asking a lot of questions, finessing the victim so that he or she is going to give enough personal information that at the other end, they're able to start putting together a pretty thorough file on you, and suddenly they can do a pretty impressive job of identity theft.
I'm thinking about the kind of details you might reveal to someone if you were starting to have an online relationship with them. Say where you were born, your mother's maiden name, all of those things that are sometimes security questions.
Exactly. And then as more time passes, you're going to drop your guard even more and start giving out even more detailed information, such as your birth date. And that's a big one right there.
The flip side of this is that, you know, a lot of people date online, meet people online. How do you go about doing that, making sure that, you know, you're safe?
You know, there's pretty established protocols for this kind of thing. For example, at first, you're going to be trading emails back and forth. If you like the cut of the person's jib, maybe photos enter the equation. Gradually, you work yourself to face-to-face until you can actually sit face-to-face with somebody and get a sense of who they are and what they're looking for in life. You just don't know. And, you know, on the internet, like the old cartoon says, nobody knows you're a dog. And that's the thing. So you want to always approach every relationship online as if it is potentially a fraud until you have moved it offline.
You've been writing about these issues for a long time. Is there any thread, do you think, about the kinds of people who get scammed? Or are we all vulnerable to this just in different ways?
Well, Lizzie, of course we're all vulnerable because all of us have our weak spots, whether that's preying on our ego or our need for some sort of validation. But generally speaking, law enforcement authorities will say that the people who report being scammed the most are, first of all, seniors, because they're trusting by nature. They come from a more trusting generation. They also are looking for people to talk to, whether online or by phone, and that makes them susceptible to these kinds of things. And some folks might lack the financial savvy to be able to see the red flags when they appear. And then just you never know, because there's always some scam that comes along that presses people's buttons. I mean, just the other day, we saw the warning that there are scammers out there trying to raise funds to fight Ebola. And every time you see a thing like this, whether it was 9/11, whether it was this or that disaster, the scammers step up with these sorts of solicitations and they pull on your heartstring. They know this. And that's why you always, always want to do your due diligence. You want to check out any charity that's contacted you. You want to check out any nonprofit that has reached out to you. You want to make sure that who you're dealing with is who they say they are.
David Lazarus, the consumer columnist at the LA Times. Again, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we know that other people can take your money and lie to you, scam you. But do you ever do it to yourself?
Well, that's only $4,000.
No, it's $40,000.
I spent $40,000 on shoes and I have no place to live? I will literally be the old woman who lived in her shoes.
So if you've acted like Carrie Bradshaw, no matter how bad or good your financial situation is, what's the one thing you'll always spend money on? Do you feel guilty? According to a poll released this week by Bankrate.com, 2/3 of Americans are watching what they spend each month. People just don't have a lot of extra money to throw around. But is there one thing you refuse to give up? Confess. Tell us your stories. Visit MarketplaceWeekend.org or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Halloween is, of course, approaching, and Marketplace's Patty Hirsch is apparently dressing up as the VIX this year. That's the Volatility Index. He joins me now. Hi, Patty.
Hello, Lizzie.
All right, your Halloween costume, what is this?
What do you mean, my Halloween costume? It's Halloween. It's coming up. You've got to get dressed up. There's parties to go to. You've got to get dressed.
And you are going as...
Well, I'm going as the scariest thing that I can think of right now, and that is the VIX.
You're such a dork. Okay, please explain the VIX to everyone.
The VIX is the scariest thing on the street. All right, there are some people who say that the bond market is the beast of Wall Street, and there's some truth to that. But I think, for my money, the VIX is the scariest thing out there. It's kind of like the headless horseman of Wall Street. It comes galloping in and scares the bejesus out of everybody. It's great. It's fantastic. So that's why I'm going as the VIX.
Okay. Explain how the VIX measures volatility.
The way it works is that the really smart numbers guys get together and they look at what traders are doing when they are trading options on the S&P 500, right? So what they're doing is they're looking how these guys are gambling about what the S&P 500 is going to do in the next 30 days. And based on those gambles, they can tell whether or not, you know, people are nervous about whether it's going to be, the market's going to be swinging up and down, if they think it's going to be very volatile, or if they think it's going to be fairly calm. So it's really just watching the way that traders are betting and then mapping that out on a graph.
So a high VIX, you know, that follows that things are not so hot.
Well, high VIX means that it's just very volatile. It means the market's like swinging up and down really, really quickly. That's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, if you're a smart buyer, you're going to be buying on the dips and, you know, selling on the highs. And that's the smart thing to do. But of course, you've got to have a pretty steely nerve to be shopping or to be trading in those kinds of conditions. So a lot of people get freaked out by it and they step out of the market altogether.
We have seen a fair amount of volatility in the markets recently. What's going on?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things going on, right? I mean, we've got Ebola, we've got conflict in the Middle East, we've got issues going on in Hong Kong, we've had some pretty dodgy earnings from some fairly big companies. I mean,
big companies,
IBM, GE. We've got fears of a global slowdown. You've got the whole issue with quantitative easing and the drawdown in government stimulus. So that's what's pushing things down. But then, you know, you've got things pushing things back up again, because here you've got falling unemployment, which is a great thing. So that's making people happy. Rising consumer sentiment, that'll make other traders happy. Falling oil prices and some very good good earnings from banks and tech companies. So you can see why you've got great pressures pushing the market down, but also great pressures pushing the market up. And what does that give you? Big swings in the market, lots of volatility.
I think maybe people who lived through the financial crisis see volatile markets and then freak out. So how often does this happen? And, you know, how common is it when we see a high VIX?
It's becoming more common more recently. I mean, we're hearing much more about the VIX. We've heard much more about it since the financial crisis. And a lot of people say part of the reason for that is because of high-frequency trading, because these machines make things move.
They trade so fast.
They trade so fast, they can really sort of magnify the way things are going. And they also move so quickly, so you really see the swings when they come in and out. But at the same, a lot of other people would argue, actually, the machines level things out. So maybe without the machines, things will be even more volatile. And the fact is that since the financial crisis, people have got very, very nervous about the markets. You've got a lot of people who are freaked out about the amount of money that they could lose, so therefore they get very, very skittish when they see things start to get a little bit unstable. They jump out of the market, and of course that then creates the swings. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
Let's say you're not one of these men or women on Wall Street who is trading every day, right? You've got a 401k or a 529 for your kid's college, or you know, you're a regular person. Should you panic?
No, you should not. Whatever you do, do not panic. Don't imagine the headless horseman riding through your living room. No, you should not panic. You should basically watch what's going on. Stay out of the market. Stay where you are right now, which is out of the market, right? You're not trading right now if you're one of those people. You're looking at the market. Don't be intimidated by those swings. I mean, if you look at what happened with the VIX just this week, it went up to this two-year high. And in the last 3 or 4 days, it's been gapping way back down again. It's down to 16 from 22, which is a huge swing. So don't freak out. Things are going to return to normal as they always do. The VIX is not for you if you are an individual investor. You're playing the long game, not the short strike.
Patty Hirsch, senior editor at Marketplace and the host of our Whiteboard video series. It's always a pleasure.
It's a consummate pleasure to be with you, Lizzie. Thank you.
Thank you. You can find Patty Hirsch's story, Why the VIX is Like the Headless Horseman, on our website, marketplace.org. And finally, before we go, this weekend you might be stocking up on candy, looking for costumes, decorating your home. And since we at Marketplace love our numbers, here are some spooky ones, courtesy of the National Retail Federation. $77. That's about what the average person will spend on Halloween. $77.52, to be exact. All that adds up to about $7.4 billion. And how about this number? Two-thirds. Two-thirds of Americans will buy Halloween costumes this year. And speaking of costumes, 23 million. That's the number of folks planning to dress up their pets this year. Our senior producer has already purchased a costume for his dog, Brisket. Brisket is going to be a taco. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next week, we'll have some brunch and hear your stories about those things in your life you refuse to do without. Don't forget to visit us. We're at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Jenny Ament. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.